teams right now, it's becoming very important to people. So I'm really interested to hear what you have to say and to share with us some of your wisdom. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. So it will be much more interesting and for both y'all and me if we can make this as casual and kind of dynamic as we can. So I'm going to be talking a lot, but I'm also going to be asking some questions of y'all. And I hope that maybe in a small group like this, we can get in a little bit more conversation than we might if it was a full room. So as Sarah said, my topic is building resilience and compassion in beloved community. I'm going to start with introducing you to my mom, Fran Campbell. First in her class at Cambridge High School in Maryland. She was first in her class at Highlands College. So many wonderful things. Mother of four, volunteer. She was an antiques expert and dealer. Taught me how to make a perfectly authentic blue crab cake, how to set a beautiful table and make everybody at that table feel really special, how to tell if a piece of porcelain was old or reproduction, how to write effectively. But she was also a product of her time, and so she taught me to let the boys win, to take off my glasses when it was picture time. And in almost every group photo I have of her, she's popping her knees like that to make herself smaller. And people do that now, but we do it a little more with, you know, kind of the stylish pop your arm out. And she was really, you can tell, especially in that second picture, kind of slumping her shoulders a little bit too, just making herself a little bit smaller, so that she wouldn't be taller than my dad. In that first picture, she's actually on the step below my dad. If she were up where that other woman is, she'd be almost a full foot taller than her. She didn't have to do that. My dad knew that he was the luckiest man in the room all the time. He loved how intelligent she was. But that indoctrination was deep from her own time. And it was deep in the way that she communicated it to me, just that idea of not taking up too much space. What I have really learned since then, and I think she'd be glad too, is that playing small doesn't serve the world and it doesn't serve God. I've had a pretty long career, which when you say 30, that's like, I usually write 25, more than 25 years, because somehow 30 seems like a lot. But I have worked for a really long time doing lots of different things. My training is in clinical psychology, but I've worked in medical and academic and nonprofit settings in addition to private practice. But for the last 2 years, I've really been doing a lot of processing about what my calling is, what it has been in the past, what I feel like it is in the present, and what I would do if I really trusted God's call for me, if I really listened to what God was telling me I'm supposed to be here doing in the world. What would I do if I weren't afraid to fail? I'm going to give you a second to read this next quote. So this gets attributed a lot to Nelson Mandela. It was actually from Marianne Williamson. But I love this quote, and you've probably heard it. I believe that as children of God, we are really called to the fullest expression of ourselves and to help other people fully and authentically express themselves by being compassionate with them. And in this particular time in the United States and in the world as a whole, I really feel like we are all being called to be our biggest, best, bravest selves. And that's going to look like different things for different people. What gets in the way is when we fall or fail, we can get negative or small. We stop being compassionate towards ourselves. We get judgy with ourselves. We get judgy with other people. And that fear of falling or failing really limits our willingness to be vulnerable and to take risks, to play it bigger. It's also scary because vulnerability is about taking risks, and Brené Brown, how many of y'all are familiar with Brené Brown? Okay, three. So I'm going to tell you really briefly, Brené Brown is a social scientist. She's a researcher at University of Houston in the social work department and has studied shame and vulnerability and courage and empathy for decades. And she has four bestseller books. Her most recent one is called Dare to Lead, and it just, came out and started at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. So she's somebody to read about and know a little bit about. And so what her research has shown when she talked to people about what courage was, that courage looks like, or vulnerability looks like weakness in me and like courage in you. We perceive it as courage in other people, but we feel really awkward and terrible about trying to do something that puts ourselves in a situation of uncertainty. And the truth is that if we're brave enough, often enough, we will fall. It's the physics of vulnerability. This is me and my little brother, who's now 6'4", not so little. When I was 10, my family took its first ski trip to Sugar Mountain, North Carolina. And I don't know what it's like there now, but back then it was just one giant sheet of ice. And I can remember that crunchy, glassy sound of the ice on my skis as I was pummeling down the slopes. I was kind of a tomboy, and I wanted to show my dad and my 14-year-old brother that I was, you know, big enough to hang with the dogs and could ski with them and not have to be on the little bunny slope with my little brother. And so I made it down the slope the first time, and I was so proud, and I had my arms up. I made it. I did it. My dad was at the bottom, and I was like, I didn't fall once. And I'll never forget my dad's response, which was, then you didn't try hard enough. If you'd really been pushing yourself, you would have fallen. Anybody can snowplow all the way down a mountain, but if you want to have fun and you want to get good, then you've got to be willing to lean into it and to take some risks. So even just telling that story now, like, I just remember that feeling of embarrassment and like I disappointed him and hadn't done what he expected me to do. But what an incredible life lesson. If I'd had a father that valued perfectionism and he'd seen me fall, then I might never have tried to ski again. But instead, I had a dad who said, push it, you can do it, it's okay, fall, get down, get back up. As Brené talks about, she says, we have to make ourselves vulnerable, we have to be willing to risk not knowing what the outcome is going to be, to embrace the suck, as she says. She's pretty colloquial from Texas. But it's when we rumble and reckon with that that we find out what we're really capable of. But most of us are okay with this kind of vulnerability, with physical vulnerability. We might be willing to try something physical and fall. But we get different messages. We grow up with different messages about emotional vulnerability. Brené says she grew up with this family mantra of lock and load. Like, you don't talk about your emotions. You don't cry in front of anybody. Don't express fear. Anybody want to share what their family messages were around vulnerability? Was it okay to show weakness? No? I'm getting some... More than the boy.
But it's an interesting observation how my husband's family is how, like,
Thank you. And so culturally, both from the places where we were raised, but also from a gender standpoint, we really get different messages about what's okay and not okay. Did you have your hand up? Okay. I got a couple of shaking heads, too, of people who didn't say anything but who are clearly communicating. No, we were not told it was okay to express our feelings. And I remember specifically, thankfully, there were four kids in my family, and the two of us were the little ones. And so the spanking as a form of discipline got used on the first two, not so much on us when they became more creative with their disciplinary practices. But I remember that line, I'll give you some, don't cry, I'll give you something to cry about. So very, very strong messages in our childhoods about what's okay and what's not okay from a vulnerability standpoint. Sorry, I got out of order here a little bit. So if we're going to risk falling, we've got to have some confidence that we're going to be able to get back up, though, right? And that's what resilience is. How would you define resilience? The strength that you can. I'm sorry, I just could.
The strength to continue.
Right. Strength to continue even when you're feeling compromised. The idea that you can get back up or that you will get back up. And the experience of getting back up. So we're going to talk just for a minute about what is it, who has it, how do we build it, why do we need it? I think we've talked a little bit about why we need it already. If we're going to risk and we're going to take those chances of falling, you have to have some kind of confidence that you've got the skill to get back up. This is a quote from the people of Haiti. Have any of y'all ever been to Haiti on a mission trip? So in 2008, the Haitians went through four hurricanes. In 2010, there was an earthquake that killed an estimated 250,000 people in a place that was already really devastated by those hurricanes and left another 1.5 million people homeless. But this is a quote from a priest there. The first one is in Haitian Creole, which I won't try to say. But the second one is, the translation is, we are like reeds. We bend, but we will not break. A lot of Episcopal churches have mission partnerships with folks in Haiti. And when I've talked to folks who have been on those trips, the way that they describe those Haitian people is the very definition of resilient. And so what the research tells us about, well, I'm going to skip that. I'm going to ask you, can you think of somebody that you know culturally, not personally, but anybody that comes to mind when you think of resilience as a celebrity, for example? Sure.
You know, our church doesn't have a relationship with community in Haiti. We did a mission experience last summer to a refugee camp in Greece.
Okay.
And I think that would be kind of
Yeah.
At least the people that live in refugee camps.
Right. Yeah, so people who've survived illness, people who have survived war and famine and earthquakes, people who've survived toxic childhoods, abusive childhoods, and a recent example is one of the newer, I forget what his position is on the Panthers, but there's a new Panthers player who has been in the news because he was apparently a childhood victim of human trafficking, and now he's this star Panthers player. He hasn't told much about his story, but somebody whose story we have heard a lot about is Oprah's. Most of us know a little bit about that story, that she was abused as a child. She actually was born to an 18-year-old mother who moved away, had her live with her grandmother and when she was three. And she lived with her grandmother from 3 to 5. When she was 5, her grandmother died, sent her back up to live with her mom. And then she did this whole back and forth between her mom and dad. She was sexually abused at age 9. She gave birth to a baby at age 14 that died 2 weeks later. That part I had not heard. And then back to her father. But she graduated at age 17 with a full 4-year scholarship to college. She was crowned Miss Black Tennessee at age 18. People talk about her running for president in 2020. What does Oprah have? What do the refugees have? What do these cancer survivors have that allows them to rise from that kind of experience? What the research tells us is these are the key characteristics of that. Some sense of innate worth, some recognition that there's purpose in their birth or in their life, a practice of gratitude, having faith or optimism, and a sense of humor. Why is it important? Because as Christians, well, really every faith, every major faith tradition has as one of its tenets this idea that we love our neighbors as ourselves. And for that to be a good thing, it's predicated on us loving ourselves well, right? If we don't love ourselves well, we're not going to be loving our neighbors very well either. Our whole selves, fearfully and wonderfully made. How do we embrace that for ourselves? How do we teach it to our children? How do we communicate it to the other people we lead whose lives we have some requirement around formation? We also are asked in our baptismal covenant, will you seek and serve Christ in all persons, loving your neighbor as yourself? How might that change the world if we really did trust and honor the divine that's in each of us? And if you link those things together, that we're told to love the Lord our God with all our heart, all our soul, and all of our mind, and love our neighbor as ourself, that idea, and seek and serve Christ in all persons, that idea that God is in us, God is in me, God is in you, if we honor that with each other, imagine how different, really, we would be operating in the world, what kind of generosity and compassion we might offer ourselves and other people. So what gets in the way of that is shame. And based on her research, she now has like 13,000 pieces of data about shame. She said, if you ever want to kill a cocktail party conversation when somebody asks you what you do for a living, tell them you're a shame researcher. But this is how Brené defines it. Shame is the intensely painful feeling that we are unworthy of love and belonging. And that arises from those moments where we feel like we're not something enough, something that we value, something that it seems like the culture values. What are some not enoughs that run through your head or that you know sort of permeate our culture? Not rich enough. Right. Not what? Not mom enough? Right. Yep. Not competent enough. So where does that come from? What limits our compassion for ourselves and for other people? I love this. And if you go to much sporting events, you see sometimes people wearing, you know, this bag of shame. So not only they're so ashamed of their team, they're not even going to show their faces at the game. When our values get challenged, like as a mother or as a leader or whatever else our role might be, as a friend, when our values get challenged, either by our own behavior or by things that are said to us, we get judgmental. We shame ourselves, and when we're in that judgy place for ourselves, we're also more inclined to judge other people. We can only have as much empathy for others as we have compassion for ourselves. And we get messages early on that acknowledging vulnerability is weakness. If you acknowledge to somebody that you don't feel like a good enough mother, then there's the risk of somebody thinking, well, maybe you aren't a good enough mother. Maybe you're trying to do too much. And we get those messages from others. We also are soaked in a media culture that lifts up perfection and highlight, you know, puts the highlight reel out there on Instagram and Facebook. And we think that everybody's house is clean and that everybody's children are polite and that everybody gets all of their work done on time and is celebrated with accomplishments because we have such a, like I said, a highlight reel in front of us all the time. And so instead of getting curious about the emotions that get generated in us when we're feeling some shame or feeling not something enough, we tend to shut it down. So we numb ourselves with busyness, with shopping, with wine. What else would you say is a good go-to? Brene says when she gets stressed, she finds herself in the pantry all the time. And she can find herself in there not having any idea what just happened. Why am I in the pantry? Somebody in my last talk said potato chips. They numb with potato chips. For me, I can find that if I realize I'm on like my second hour of scrolling through Facebook and reading articles, and I have learned now to go, huh, am I really enjoying this and entertaining myself, or am I avoiding feeling something or doing something that I should get curious about? So what if, in the context of that shame, we decided to show up anyway? What if we risked vulnerability? What if we weren't the perfect mom, but we still took our messy, not put together kids to church because we value being at church more than we value the kids looking perfect? What if we decided to show up in our imperfection anyway? When I was talking to somebody about this, Jimmy Carter came to my mind. Some of you aren't old enough to remember Jimmy Carter's presidency, but he's had a lot of criticism as a president about whether he was effective enough and whether he did the right things around the hostage crisis and the oil embargo. And there were all kinds of things going on that really diminished his effectiveness during his presidency. But he's 96 years old, and he's still out building houses for Habitat for Humanity. He's still walking home from church every night in plane, or every Wednesday and Sunday nights from planes, holding Rosalind's hand. He knows whose he is. He knows what his values are. And he didn't allow things that didn't go as well as he hoped or as other people hoped to make him shrink into sort of ignominy? Anyway, into not being known. The Carter Center in Atlanta is one of the most phenomenal places and doing incredible things all over the world. So I think about people like him. So what if we decided to show up, to belong to ourselves, to belong to God, to be our most authentic selves, which might not be the most athletic or the richest or the smartest or the funniest or the most charismatic speaker, because I know I'm not that. But what if we decided to show up anyway, because we're doing something that we care about and because we feel like what we have is important to the world. If we started saying no when we really meant no, if we put limits around the things that we committed to do, that we stopped comparing about whether our kids are doing all the activities that everybody else's kids are doing, or whether we're on enough boards, or whatever it is that the shoulds are in your life that you feel like are making you do things that are outside of where your values really lie, and sometimes can put you out of integrity, because when you're stressed, we sometimes act outside of our integrity. We're mean to people. We're short with our spouses. We're short with our kids. We may be shaming of employees. When we get in places where we're really feeling pushed, we're much more likely to not be empathic with ourselves or with other people. So where does that willingness to be vulnerable come from? That sense of worth, the sense of innate worth, that there's something that drives your willingness to be able to show up. I was going to do a little talk and turn about where you get your sense of self-worth, but we're kind of spread apart. But is anybody willing to say sort of where does that come from for you, that idea that you are innately worthy and it's not dependent on what you do? I'm sorry? Childhood. Can everybody hear that? That it's that the messages around our self-worth are set up early. And can get communicated positively or negatively. And that's why I think that earlier research that we talked about, that sense of innate worth, while it is the primary predictor of resilience, having some sense that you are worthy and your story matters because you matter, that does seem to be the number one predictor of resilience for people. And it doesn't necessarily have to come from your parents. It could have come from a coach, from a grandparent, from a teacher.
But is it from an external source?
No. So say more about that. I'm inviting you to say more. Right. So I think, so innate implies that it is innate. I mean, and I think I would posit that we are born with that innate worth, that it's God-given, that it's part of the divine that's in each of us, but it can get crushed, that awareness of that innate worth can get crushed by the messages that we get from people outside of us, or it can get lifted up. Oprah had a grandmother who taught her how to read by age 3, and so that communicated something to her. She saw her story in Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and she related to that. She felt represented in that. So there are external sources where we can look for some validation that triggers that innate sense of worthiness. But that innate worth is not the only thing. And so people that do struggle around that, there are also 4 or 5 other things that we can work on building in folks as well, that we talked about earlier. What's my time? I feel like I'm going long.
It's 10:48.
And what time do we stop?
11-ish.
Okay. All right. So I'm going
to...
Okay. Okay. So I'm going to speed through a couple of things real quick. So that's yucky though, right? The digging in, the getting curious about why we feel ashamed, about what that's triggering for us, what early messages it's triggering, what values are being challenged. That's the messy part. And we just want to skip that usually, right? You want to hear that Oprah had a tough childhood, but now she's the richest woman in America. We want to hear that this guy, you know, survived this terrible childhood, but look at him now. And we skip that messy part where people grew into the person that they are. So I love this image of the butterfly going from caterpillar to larva to butterfly. Do you know the story about the man who tried to shortcut that? Anybody heard that one? So I'll really quickly do it. Sounds like you could tell it for me. But the story is that there was a man watching a butterfly emerge from a cocoon. And he watched it for hours. He watched it pushing and pushing and seeing this cocoon get all, you know, squishy. And then finally, a tiny hole was formed in the bottom of the cocoon. And again, he watched this emerging butterfly trying to get itself out of this tiny hole. And after forever, it seemed like, of watching this happen, it stopped. And it seemed like the butterfly was giving up and not able to get out. And so he decided to help it and got a little pair of scissors and just snipped a little bit bigger hole so that the butterfly could get out. And it dropped out of the hole. But what he saw was this sort of shriveled half caterpillar, half butterfly, and watched it take its last breath, never able to fly away. And I think that's such an incredible metaphor, and I use it a lot with clients in my clinical practice because it's the struggle that formed those wings. It's the struggle that got all the goop in the right places and really creates that being that emerges able to take flight like that. It's so easy to want to shortcut it for ourselves. It's so easy, especially, I think, to want to shortcut it for our children, to clear a path for them that makes them not have to struggle. But sometimes that extra effort is exactly what's preparing us for the next obstacle to be faced. And so anybody that refuses to make that effort is really going to be unprepared for the flight into their destiny. So how do we lean into that? How do we decide, or what gives us sort of the spiritual strength to stick through that and to trust that we're going to come out on the other side okay? I love this idea of conceptualizing rising strong as a spiritual practice. Brené says, rising strong after a fall is how we cultivate wholeheartedness in our lives. It's the process that teaches us the most about who we are. And as we talked about earlier, self-compassion is really at the key to that, at the core of that. There's a researcher at University of Texas in Austin who's in the nursing school, and she talks about the influence on self-compassion as a predictor of positive outcome in all kinds of things. It's if people who are self-compassionate or who treat themselves kindly have much better health outcomes across the board, diabetes, alcoholism, cancer. Believing that you deserve love and kindness is a huge predictor of your ability to positively survive things like that. So there are three elements to self-compassion that she's found. One is this idea of self-kindness versus self-judgment. People who exhibit self-compassion talk to themselves like a beloved friend. They don't say mean things to themselves. How many of us say mean things to ourselves when we mess up? But self-compassion involves being warm and understanding toward ourselves when we fail or feel inadequate, rather than ignoring it or beating ourselves up about it. And people who are self-compassionate recognize that being imperfect, failing, going through difficulties in life is inevitable, and so they tend to be more gentle with themselves. I don't think that this is some indicator that they in particular are bad people or not worthy of love and belonging. The second one is common humanity versus isolation. And this has to do with that idea that we're not alone in our suffering. We're not the only person who ever felt like a bad mom. We're not the only person who got fired. We're not the only person who went through a divorce. And that's not to minimize our experience of those things, but it's recognizing this feeling, this emotion, this experience is something that's shared all across the planet. And so we're not alone in that. Self-compassion is recognizing that pain is part of the human experience. And then the third one is mindfulness versus over-identification. And mindfulness kind of gets a bad rap as a woo-woo kind of concept, but it really is just about paying attention. It's about noticing what's going on for you. And so it's taking a balanced approach to our negative emotions. It's recognizing them so that and being willing to explore them so we don't feel like we have to exaggerate them or suppress them. So mindfulness is really just that non-judgmental accepting state of, I feel really embarrassed right now, but I am not an embarrassment. Over-identification is becoming that emotion that you're feeling, whereas mindfulness is just recognizing that it's there. I made a mistake, but I am not a mistake. I feel ashamed about something, but I am not shameful. So I wanted to take a second and just talk about how that, and we're wrapping up, and I'm going to give you a brief exercise to do. But I wanted to talk about how Brené has applied that within parenting. And I know, how many of y'all are actively parenting kids right now? Okay, so about half. How many have adult children? And then we've also probably have people that we are responsible for leading, either in the parish or in our jobs. And I think there are ways to apply this to that as well. And I'd also refer you to a book called Dare to Lead, which just came out, is about how all of this applies in a leadership kind of capacity. But what Brené did was take all of this information about shame and resilience and self-compassion and write a parenting manifesto for her family, and you can find this on brenebrown.com, and I actually probably have enough copies for people here if you want one. But I'm going to read it to you real quick because I think it incorporates all of this. Above all else, I want you to know that you are loved and lovable. You will learn this from my words and actions. The lessons on love are in how I treat you and how I treat myself. I want you to engage in the world from a place of worthiness. You will learn that you are worthy of love, belonging, and joy every time you see me practice self-compassion and embrace my own imperfections. We will practice courage in our family by showing up, letting ourselves be seen, and honoring vulnerability. We will share our stories of struggle and strength. There will always be room in our home for both. We will teach you compassion by practicing compassion with ourselves first, then with each other. We will set and respect boundaries. We will honor hard work, hope, and perseverance. Rest and play will be family values as well as family practices. You will learn accountability and respect by watching me make mistakes and amends and by watching how I ask for what I need and how I talk about how I feel. I want you to know joy, so together we will practice gratitude. I want you to feel joy, so together we will learn how to be vulnerable. When uncertainty and scarcity visit, you will be able to draw from the spirit that's part of our everyday life. Together we will cry and face fear and grief. I will want to take away your pain, but instead I will sit with you and teach you how to feel it. We will laugh and sing and dance and create.
We will always have permission to be ourselves with each other, no matter what. You will always belong here. As you begin your wholehearted journey, the greatest gift I can give you is to live and love and with my whole heart and to dare greatly. I will not teach or love or show you anything perfectly, but I will let you see me, and I will always hold sacred the gift of seeing you, truly, deeply seeing you. So I'm going to invite you into one new practice. We talked earlier about all those different characteristics of resilience. Do you remember the list besides innate worth and gratitude? Do you remember what some of the other ones were? Sense of humor, faith and optimism, innate worth, gratitude and purpose, sense of purpose. So these are things that we can practice. We can practice them ourselves. We can teach our children. We can teach our partners. And this one practice of gratitude is, I think, one of the most powerful ones, because there are a lot of times where we feel fearful and vulnerable or mad or sad, but being able to find something to be grateful about and to say that out loud and to say that to somebody else is really transformative, and there's an enormous amount of data about this as well. So the gratitude practice, and I'm going to ask you to do this. Do we have enough people for everybody to partner up? I think we do, actually. So I'm going to ask you to turn to your partner and say three things that you feel grateful about. So can you guys turn with each other? You're going to say... Okay, so here's what I will encourage you to do. Do that when you get home. Make a plan for it. Decide how you're going to do it, with whom, and where, and practice that this week and see what happens. So the rest of you, maybe you can go with a threesome, but say three things that you feel grateful about.